If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. Gentlemen, we have a serious problem. The Limeys are taking over Astronomy.fm.
Welcome to Under British Skies, an Astronomy.fm original program with Richie Jarvis, Paul Harper, Nick Evitts, Nick Howes, and Jane A. Green. The show is engineered by Michael Forster and Rob Keehan and produced by the team. Previous episodes of Under British Skies are available to download for free from the Astronomy.fm website or on the iTunes Astronomy.fm channel. You can contact the team during the show via the Astronomy.fm chat room by emailing ubs@astronomy.fm, via our Under British Skies Facebook page, or via our Twitter account at Under British Sky.
Good evening and welcome to episode 41 of Under British Skies. My name's Richie Jarvis, and with this episode, we're looking at the Cosmic Distance Ladder. But before we start on that, I guess I better introduce the team. So I'll start off with my colleague, Jane Green.
Thank you, Richie. Yes, I'm Jane Green. I'm author, speaker, and broadcaster on astronomy.
And Nick Howes.
I'm Nick Howes, astronomer working with the Keeler Observatory in Northumberland and writer for various magazines.
And, of course, finishing off with Nick Evitts.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Nick Evitts. I'm an astro imager and radio amateur, and I'm a radio astronomer too.
Thank you very much, guys. And I'm Richie Jarvis. I'm an amateur astronomer based in the south of England. Right, we're going to start off with a bit of news for you this evening. So, first of all, Nick, I believe you were going to talk to us about something that got found this week.
Yes, the lost dog. So for some of the listeners, I mean, the people who've been in a cave for the last 10 years, you may not have heard, there was a little spacecraft called Beagle 2, famously named after Darwin's original Beagle craft from the 1800s. And that was part of a European Space Agency mission known as Mars Express, which successfully went into orbit around Mars around about late 2002, 2003. And the idea was that it was going to deploy this kind of coffee table size lander onto the surface of Mars. It was a very audacious mission, and basically it was believed to have been destroyed as it went in 2003, because it was due to send back a call sign on Christmas Day and nothing was heard. And for several days they kept basically looking and saying, okay, we don't know where it is. And then it was lost for 10 years. Now, about a year and a half ago, the HiRISE instrument on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is probably the most sophisticated camera in orbit around Mars, started imaging an area which it believed the spacecraft could be in, the wreckage they so believed of the spacecraft. There have been all sorts of attempts to look for it over the last 10 years. None had really been successful. There was a kind of tantalizing belief in 2005 that they may have found it. Anyway, so around about a year and a half ago, it looked like they may have something. And it's taken over a year of additional imaging, image processing, analysis, etc., to really come to a conclusion now that a lot of people at the UK Space Agency and people involved with the mission now believe they have definitely found the spacecraft on the surface of Mars, and that it landed intact. It was a flawless EDL. The ascent, you know, entry, descent, and landing of the mission were flawless. So, in a way, it kind of vindicates the mission, which at the time came in for an awful lot of criticism and a lack of support, specifically, surprisingly, from the European Space Agency, who almost washed their hands of the mission and treated it much as a kind of science package rather than a unique spacecraft in its own right. But it looks like it landed, the back shell deployed, the parachutes have been found, and they think at least two of the solar panels that were critical for the power have actually unfurled. What needed to happen, however, was all the solar panels needed to unfurl, because underneath the solar panels was the radio transmitter, which would then transmit the signal, which was a call sign designed by the pop group Blur, up to Mars Express and then back onto Earth. It was an incredible mission. Cost less than a soccer player. A Premiership soccer player can cost more than this mission cost. It was about £42 million, so about $60, $70 million, which is staggeringly cheap for a space mission. Had it had a bit more backing and a bit more support, it probably would have succeeded. But in the kind of great British tradition, it's now seen as a kind of successful failure.
Yeah, very much so, Nick. And of course, there's soon to be a petition, I believe, that's going to try and get a posthumous knighthood for Dr. Colin Pillinger, who was the big man in this.
Well, this was the thing. Colin Pillinger, again, if you're not aware of who he was this kind of larger-than-life, very eccentric character from the West Country in England. He looked like a kind of farmer-type character, very kind of big mutton-chop type of beard. Fantastic guy. Really, really amazing guy. Full of passion, full of energy, exactly what you need in astronomy. And he was literally wheeling his spacecraft around in a shopping cart sometimes, you know, basically hand over fist, begging for money from all sorts of different places. He got loads of people working on the mission for free. I mean, it's charisma. This guy just oozed the stuff. Now, sadly, he started to degenerate not long after the mission kind of was deemed to be a failure, and sadly passed away last May, which is a real, real tragedy, because up until that time, you know, I was at conferences where academics were literally laughing at him, and it really upset me. It really, really angered me more than anything, the fact that this guy had done so much to inspire kids, to inspire British science, etc., and was just laughed at. So, yeah, I've set up this idea to get the guy posthumously knighted. He had a CBE, a Commander of the British Empire Award, various other awards as well, but I just think the guy should be posthumously knighted for his achievements for, you know, inspiring kids, inspiring science. And so I've put in this thing to the government in the UK to basically put up a petition, hopefully get loads of people to sign it to get this happening.
Brilliant. Thanks, Nick. And once we get a link for that petition, wherever it may be, we will actually put it up on the in the show notes and start shouting about it as well, because I think you're right. I mean, but as well as that, there were a couple of other mission scientists who involved with the Beagle 2 mission, who also unfortunately died last year as well. I'm just trying to find their names, unfortunately, but Colin Pillinger was certainly one of the best known.
How long did Colin work on the project? It must have been years.
It was years before. Don't forget, Colin Pillinger first came into the kind of public domain with work on the Apollo lunar samples. I mean, the guy's a genius geologist. He was geochemist, geologist, got himself into astronomy, and you know, his pedigree is immense. He worked on the Rosetta mission. You know, the last time I was with Colin was at the Rosetta press conference at EPSC just over a year ago. And, you know, again, knowing he was dying, he was still so passionate about the mission. And I just find it such a tragedy that he didn't know his spacecraft had survived, even though, as I said, some of the earliest images came, I think, from November 2013. So a good 6 months before he passed away, they thought they may have imaged something. So who knows? I mean, he may have known. We don't know. But just, you'd like to hope, you know, if he is up there looking down on people for, you know, for whatever reason, that he's smiling now with his kind of his wry, happy smile saying, yeah, I told you so. Because he always believed he'd landed.
Let's hope so.
And he was right. He was absolutely spot on. And, you know, hats off to him.
Well, it means that the UK are the first European country to successfully have a soft landing on the surface of Mars. I mean, if you remember...
That's huge. That's huge too, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing. Russia, you know, the Soviet Union, obviously, all through the 60s and 70s, apart from Mars 3 for 15 seconds, have had no success. Absolutely zero. Mm-hmm. Mars is a tricky thing to do. And to do this on such a restricted budget, you know, with all the, you know, the high powers at ESA, etc., basically just disregarding it, laughing at it, etc. I mean, there's some amazing guys at ESA, don't get me wrong, the ESOC telemetry guys, all the people who really did support the mission, fantastic job that they did. But there's so little support because they just saw this as quirky, okay, they haven't got the budget, they haven't got the money, all sorts of different things. It's ridiculous. It needed support and a bit more testing, a bit more support, and, you know, who knows what would have found. It was designed to find life. And now they're sending ExoMars on a Russian launch system again. And as I said, the Russians have had zero success in terms of getting stuff to Mars, really.
Yeah.
I mean, Russia launched Mars Express, obviously, and that now could be deemed to be a success with Beagle, but very, very low success rate. And, you know, NASA had the Mars, you know, the issue with the Polar Lander, etc., with, you know, pounds per square meter, for want of a better term. And then they came back with Phoenix. That's the way to do it, is to look at this and say, right, we were so close. Now what do we do?
Maybe we should ask the Indians to do it, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
They struck right first time round.
Absolutely. Now, something that I know is close to all of our hearts, of course, is his Comet C 2014 Q2 Lovejoy. Nick, do you want to go on first on this one? Because you've taken some
stunning images.
Stunning images.
Okay, well, it's only made possible by this remarkable Australian amateur astronomer who's using something akin to an average backyard telescope, and this is his fifth comet. I mean, Terry Lovejoy is an amazing guy. He is spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours basically scouring the skies, because don't forget, Australian Southern Hemisphere, since the canning of Rob McNaught due to budget issues, and you know, don't even get me started on that one, because that's just obscene. But Terry Lovejoy is basically now almost single-handedly, you know, doing the amateur community proud with multiple discoveries of comets. And he found this one, T2014 Q2, obviously last year, and it looked like it was going to be an interesting comet. It's stunning, this thing. I mean, the ion gas tail on it, measured as of today, is about 26 degrees in length. So we're looking at a tail around about 60 to 70 million kilometers long already. It's hardly producing any dust. The dust output from this thing is really, really low compared to some comets, but the gas ion tail is amazing. It's just stretching across, and recently it's been very close to the Pleiades. It's in kind of Taurus area, working its way up, and there's some just amazing photography opportunities with it as well. So I've been imaging it with the robotic network in Australia. It's getting kind of low now for Australia. It's really moving more into the northern hemisphere, so anyone in the northern hemisphere who can get out, it's naked eye visible if you're on a good dark sky location. Get a pair of binoculars on it. I mean, I took my 8-year-old daughter out a couple of weeks back, or a week or so ago, to have a look at it, and it's an amazing thing for even a pair of average binoculars just to look at. It's this great big green fuzzy ball with, you know, tail extending away, as I said, 26 degrees in some of the long exposure images. It's a phenomenal object, and you know, it's a lot of water, a lot of ice coming off it, from what the calculations are showing. It's one of those kind of rare gem comets that we've been missing for a long time, I'd say, since really Hale-Bopp. And it's not as bright as Hale-Bopp, but, I mean, it's a good comet to see.
Do you know when it hits, when it's going to reach perihelion? Because
it's this week, yeah. It's not like long. It's a few days now, isn't it, to perihelion, depending on when our listeners listen to this show.
yeah, I think 28th, isn't it?
Oh, is it 28th?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Go outside, clear night, go outside, take a pair of binoculars. It's obvious enough that I was even able to show my wife it. So
steady on. No, but that's absolutely right. I was out with a friend just a couple of nights ago when it was really clear. And you know, even if you have no idea what you're looking at, which a lot of people don't have any idea, just get out there, get near Taurus, and get scanning, because, as you say, Nick, it's unmissable.
Yeah, so it's beautiful. It's fuzzy and it is
loud and proud.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to say that. My wife couldn't find it. Is that it? Yes, that's it, darling.
Yeah.
Perihelion is on the 30th.
Oh, on the 30th.
Yeah, I thought it was.
Thank you.
It's interesting as well in that there's a group called the Packer Group that we've talked about before, a Pro-Am Comet kind of community group that's administered and run by one of our regular guests, Padma Yanamandra Fisher. And they're very, very actively involved in taking a lot of data on this. So if anyone has got any images that they want to submit on the Facebook, the PACA group and the Comet, the CIOC group as well, which is Carl Battams and his team, if you want to get in touch, you know, we'd love to see more and more images taken of this. And they can be anything from sketches. They don't have to even be photographs. There's a lot of people doing sketches, as long as you're doing good detailed observations. As you know, I've seen images taken with an iPhone today of this comet. It's so bright, which is quite remarkable. But it's one of those things that, you know, get out there, get a camera, get a pair of binoculars, just have a good look, and you know, if you can take any measurements of it, submit them, because all data is good data.
Yeah. Okay. The next thing we've got on, something sad thing that happened this week. Well, sort of sad, is the US. The US segment of the International Space Station was evacuated because of a possible leak of ammonia. Ammonia is used for the cooling system inside the space station, and unfortunately a sensor malfunctioned, and the entire US segment had to disappear off to the Russian segment.
How long for, Richie?
I mean, they weren't in there for very long. They were, I think they were in there for less than 24 hours. But now they've been allowed to go back. They've figured out that this was a malfunction on the sensor. And so everybody's back in their proper places now, which is good news. Right, next thing. Ah, yes, a Jupiter opposition on the 6th of February, of course. So next month, early next month, Jupiter will be at opposition. Best time to view Jupiter, of course. On the 24th of January, though, there will be three Galilean moon shadows transiting across the surface of the planet. So that's definitely worth going and having a look at. There's not a lot in the media about this at the moment. There was something on the Sky at Night the other day. The link I've put in the show notes is simply... The link I put in the show notes was actually posted back in December, but if you scroll to the bottom there, 24th of January at 6:40 Greenwich Mean Time, you should be able to see the shadows of Europa, Callisto and Io on the surface of the planet. Now, any reasonable size telescope should be able to pick it up, you know, in a decent eyepiece and a nice non-turbulent atmosphere.
When you say a reasonable size telescope though, Richie, what do you mean?
You're mean. On a sort of like, you know...
Four to six inch refractor, easily pick it up. An 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain grain, 6 to 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain grain and higher, you get it. You only have to look at some of the images that are coming out of people like Damien Peach, etc. You know, they're not just capturing the transit events, they're capturing surface detail on the moons as they're transiting Jupiter. So it's one of those things now, I think, where, you know, anyone can really get involved in this. If you've got a local astronomy society, try and see if they're doing anything special for these events and go out, because somebody there is going to have a decent sized telescope.
And you really should, shouldn't you? Because this is such a rare event. I think the next one isn't until 2036, if I'm right. It's quite some time away, so you need to get looking now.
Yeah, definitely. And it is fascinating that you can actually see the shadows of real moons on the surface of another planet.
And again, as well, you know, just as Nick was saying, in fact, it was just the other night, it was just so clear. Take your binoculars out there and you can see, you know, the largest, the four Galilean moons of Jupiter with a pair of binoculars. You know, a lot of people think, well, you know, you can't see, what can you see with a pair of binoculars? Well, the answer is quite a lot. You just need to get out there and get looking.
Right. The next thing I wanted to talk about, Next thing I wanted to talk about is published back at the beginning of January. Sorry about that, I forgot to put my mute on. Is the Hubble Space Telescope has revisited the iconic Pillars of Creation image. It was taken approximately, or about 20 years ago now. For those of you that haven't seen it, this is the well, it's an iconic image. It's taken in narrowband, so it's sulfur 2, hydrogen alpha, and oxygen 3. It is just one of the defining images that we got to see.
It's probably one of the three most famous images ever taken of anything in space.
It really caught the attention of the public and had wide coverage, didn't it? So I think if anyone thinks of a Hubble image, that's probably the first one they're going to think of.
Yeah, it was absolutely beautifully done. I mean, it was not only the science was great, as Richie was saying, the filters that they use these three narrowband filters, but they use them in a very kind of different configuration to what was the norm at the time. And it's now become really the norm even for amateur images, who can buy these filters really off the shelf and use it to kind of replicate those colours. And it's aesthetically beautiful as well. But what they've redone, the 20th anniversary shot, is just incredible. It really is. It expands on the original image so much more.
Stunning. Go and have a look. There's also a huge one there that you can zoom into. And also, they also took an infrared image as well, which shows a little bit more detail about what's going on behind the dust that we couldn't see previously in the narrowband image. So, well worth a look. And if you go onto the NASA website, you can go and download a large copy, wallpaper or whatever you fancy, and then
you know, the full-size original is 18 megabytes, for example. So quite a big image, lots of detail there, and well worth a look. Well worth a look indeed. Right,
that's,
who wants
that's
to...
That's the infrared image, basically. Well, it goes through the clouds, doesn't it? So you're looking at a stellar nursery at the fingertips of the Pillars of Creation, and the infrared really pierces into that and shows you these stars actually being born. It's, yeah, it's staggering. Anyway.
Nick Evetts, could you tell us about the close pass of an asteroid which is coming along soon?
Yes, certainly. It seems to be slightly garbled in the press. One tabloid in the UK has said it's the closest pass of an asteroid in about 200 years. Bit over the top there, I think. We have had some more recently. It is asteroid 2004 BL86. It's going to fly very close to us on the 28th of this month. So just, and the best story I've seen about it so far is on Astronomy Now, and its reflective brightness astronomers estimate the asteroid is about a third of a mile, which is 0.5 of a kilometer in size. Now, it's going to be the closest by any known space rock this large until asteroid 1999 AN10 flies past the Earth in 2027. So at the time of its closest approach, the asteroid will be approximately 1.2 million kilometers from the Earth. And if you the link is going to be available in the show notes, so do go have a look at the news story and at the graphics which have been provided there. Bloody good stuff. Richie, next.
Okay, so the next one we've got is on the 22nd of November, 2014, the Rosetta spacecraft took a beautiful image with their OSIRIS camera of the comet it's currently orbiting, Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Now, it's only just been released on the 16th of January, and we'll have a little talk about that in a minute, but it is well worth a look. You can really see the jets coming off the image. They've overexposed it beautifully. It was taken from a distance of 30 kilometres away, and it's... basically, they wanted to see the activity on the comet. So I'm really hoping that we're going to see a lot more images like this showing how the, you know, how the comet is becoming active in its orbit. Of course, the only problem is with this is that that image was taken back in November. Nick, do you want to say something about that?
there's a lot of controversy over this. I mean, basically what happened was when the mission was first being designed, there were all sorts of contracts set up between the mission principal investigators, the PIs, the scientists, mission scientists on all the instruments, basically giving them a carte blanche six-month embargo on image release data, for example, with OSIRIS. Now, if you compare and contrast this with NASA's policy, which is basically get it out there as soon as possible, you only have to remember the MSL landing on Mars, where basically within a few seconds of them touching down, they were showing images of the wheels on the surface, and they've been putting out the raw data ever since. And, you know, high-rise, all of these missions, these spectacularly successful missions, both scientifically and from a visual standpoint for the members of the public, they get their data out straight away in a lot of cases. It's not always the case, but in a lot of cases it is. With Huygens, for example, you know, if you remember the night of the Huygens landing, we saw fantastic images from the surface, which is still, you know, iconic to this day, of the Huygens lander on the surface, and its descent through the atmosphere came out very quickly. I just think with OSIRIS, they got it wrong, and I'm not the only one. There's hundreds and thousands of people who have said this, and they're really upset about it. And what's happened this week with a BBC news story is that Jean-Jacques Dordain, who's ESA's Director General, has said, yes, this needs to change. Even he's in agreement now.
Yes, it's definitely one of those things where, you know, this is something where, you know, the general public is funding these missions. You know, we're all funding them, you know, so... No,
yeah, with NASA,
you're not allowed to embargo things. Release the data.
No, you can understand from the scientist's point of view, you can understand that they basically don't want people stealing their thunder. You know, these guys have worked on it for decades, years, decades in some cases. And what has even been seen now is that some of the images being released, people were trying to basically use that data to publish their own papers that weren't part of the OSIRIS team. So you can kind of see where they're coming from, but what's the harm in releasing JPEGs? You're not releasing spectroscopy, you're not releasing mineralogy, you're not releasing any kind of really high resolution data. You're releasing JPEGs of something which is stunning. It's the first time in history we've orbited a comet, and everybody was so excited about this, and then it's kind of soured it a little bit. I wouldn't say too much, because the NavCam images themselves are pretty good, and there's been some great NavCam image releases, but the OSIRIS camera releases are amazing. The other good one, though, I guess, tying in with the Beagle story, is that, you know, ESA now hopefully have got some hope that they're going to find Philae, because if HiRISE can find Beagle after so many years, let's hope that they can, in fact, find the Philae lander in time for possibly it waking up earlier in the next few months anyway.
It's in a cave. It must be in a cave.
It's in a dark place. We know that.
Is that metaphorically speaking, or?
I don't know. I don't know. Where, as Nick says, wherever it is, it's dark.
Yes.
Dark and damp, and it's probably got monsters around it or something. Yeah.
It's true, though. It is such a shame, as you say, because, you know, the public was so excited, and they are JPEG images, and, you know, when you remember how excited we were about, you know, the Pillars of Creation and how quickly we were able to see those and how that excited people more, it is a shame that we sort of almost sort of lost the moment in that respect.
I just don't get it, because, I mean, basically, if you drill back to 1986 with you know, Giotto and Halley, we were getting, you know, Patrick Moore bouncing around the room saying, look at that,
yes,
look at that, almost live images coming in. Now, I'm sorry, what changed? Who decided that this was a good idea? Because, like I said, even if JJD himself says, this is bad, this is wrong, this should not happen again, and the ExoMars team are now working on what they're going to do, it's, yeah, anyway.
I think we've all reached the same conclusion.
I think so.
Yeah.
Right, Nick, you've got one final story for us before we start talking about the size of the universe.
Yes, in a scene reminiscent of Gerry Anderson's Thunderbirds, the first attempt to recover a rocket on a floating barge, well, it blew up. They missed it. They were going a little bit too fast. They were a little bit off course, and the SpaceX Falcon 9 crashed spectacularly in flames onto the landing barge. However, I don't think this is going to be actually the last time they'll try it. The SpaceX are probably sitting there looking at the data, saying, what did we do wrong? What did we do right? Let's see if we can do this again. Because the good part of it is that they're attempting to reuse, make the rocket reusable. They're recycling the equipment, so that's always good. But as I say, I suppose if you're my age, you probably do remember those wonderful opening scenes of Thunderbirds, where there's this humongous explosion, and I think this is what is was seen by the Falcon 9 team when they tried it. Go to the BBC website. We'll put the link into the show notes, folks, and watch the video. I'd say 8 out of 10 for effort, but no cigar. And
I think they did a brilliant job. I've got to say, you know, for me, getting it that close, I mean, that's pretty close. First try,
yeah.
That's pretty good. It's pretty good,
it's,
I reckon.
I go even further than that. It's astonishing. They're trying something that's never been done before. And, you know, the thing with Elon Musk, and you can say what you like about the guy has no fear. He really is kind of Iron Man. He's been said before about him. And he's willing to try anything. And if they can pull this off, the cost of, you know, low Earth orbit, you know, supply missions to the ISS is going to plummet. And that can only be a good thing, because hopefully then it will allow more funding to go into the deep space missions, exploration missions, etc. If NASA aren't spending, you know, however many $100 million per launch anymore, if we can keep the cost down, fantastic. It's got to be applauded, no matter what. You know, if they crash again, they can crash again and again and again. Just keep going. Look at the US space program in the early 60s. You know, the Kaputnik and all the other explosion, you know, with the various launches that they tried. it happened. It's not easy. So massive, massive props to SpaceX, I think, for this.
Even more so, I think the fact that they actually released that video footage as well, a lot of companies would have tried to hide it. And I think The fact that they didn't hide it, or they, you know, they didn't cover it up, and they just said, hey, look, this is what went wrong, this is what happens. Oh, and hey, look how cool this explosion is.
Yeah.
If you don't make mistakes, you won't learn.
Correct. I think that's the important thing. Mr. Branson's learning that with his trip to low Earth orbit.
They hadn't know what did they actually.
Basically, they thought they were going to testing a new fuel for the for the spacecraft, and then it all went wrong. Something happened. Something caused the drag to engage, and then suddenly, bam! But again, it wasn't covered up. He was in front of the cameras. I'm on my way there. I'm going to find out what's going on. We're going to get it fixed. We are going to take passengers to low Earth orbit. So, the good thing is, keep trying. Don't give up. Keep trying. NASA spent 10 years. Getting themselves to the point where they could put a man on top of that rocket and put him into a suborbital flight. Does it matter if it takes 10 years? No. It's going to help bring the costs down. And the really good thing is it allows NASA to concentrate on the space launch system to get Orion commissioned and to get us back where we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be in high Earth orbit. We're supposed to be actually cruising in that area between the Earth, the Moon, and Mars, making the discoveries we need to make. And that's going to help us get there. That's my 10 pence anyway.
Sounds good to me, Nick. Sounds good to me. Right. So what have we got for the rest of the show? Well, we're talking about the cosmological distance ladder. So this is basically... This came from a late night, I can't sleep type moment. And I suggested it to the rest of the team. And we decided to go with it. But I was sat there, lying in bed, as you do, couldn't sleep, and I started thinking about, okay, well, how do we know that thing over there that I'm looking at through my telescope is that far away? You know, and I knew, a little bit about how it worked and how astronomers worked out distances, but I wanted to look into it a little bit more. So that's really the basis of this show, is to actually try and look a little bit more into how professional astronomers work out how far away something is. And also, you know, how accurate is it? How can we turn around and say that this star here is, 400 light years away? Is that 400 light years plus or minus, 10%, 20%, 30%? Who knows? So I kind of just wanted to look into that a little bit more. So let's start off back in the beginning. I mean, it's only in the last 200 years really that astronomers have looked up in the night sky and realized that stars are actually outside our own solar system. There was no way to actually understand where distant stars were, where they were in relation to everything else. They were able to, or Kepler was able to look back in the early days at the relationships and orbits between different planets, but, how did it all fit together? We've got a pre-record that Jane and myself did with Dr. Robert Smith from the University of Sussex, which explains an awful lot about how all this stuff works from a professional astronomer's point of view. But first of all, I just wanted to talk to the rest of the team. What's everybody else's understanding of how we work out distances? I'll start with Nick House, I think.
Kepler, I mean, basically, as far as the universe is concerned for me, my interest in comets and NEOs and asteroids, etc., it's all down to Kepler and Kepler's, three laws, basically second and third law, give us a relationship between distance, orbits, etc. And I find that just amazing that you're going back 500-600 years, and even from the time of Aristotle through to like the mid-16th century, something like a comet was treated as an atmospheric phenomena. I mean, people still believe that these things were in our own atmosphere. And it was all the astrologers, and they were the guys that were really interested in this. And it took, you know, between Tycho Brahe, Kepler, Copernicus, and all of these great thinkers of the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th century, you know, the real Enlightenment period, to kind of give us the mathematical basis that we need for deriving these distances and laws. Obviously, you've got things like parallax, where, you know, easy way to explain parallax, if you hold out your thumb at arm's length, for example, and you blink between your left eye and your right eye, your thumb moves. And this is the kind of principle of, you know, you're looking at something nearby to you, say your thumb, and then you look at something in the background, it won't move as far. And this is the principle that they use for a lot of objects up to about 1,000 parsecs out, I believe, is about the greatest you can get, where you've got the Earth's orbit and you've got a 2 AU baseline in the Earth's orbit between the time it's on one side of the sun and time it's on the other side of the sun, the 6 month period. And you can measure then, you know, for static objects like planets, for example, or star positions, if you've got stars with proper motion, you can work out the shift of the nearest stars relative to the background stars using this, you know, basic trigonometry. But beyond that, you're going into the realms of, you know, standard candles and luminosity and all these kind of different measures now that have, like I said, only come out in the last 100, 200 years maximum. So to me, I just find it amazing, really, really fantastic.
What I find amazing is that it wasn't until really the 1930s that we actually realized that there was another galaxy outside our own. We felt that, you know, this galaxy was the universe, and that the other galaxies out there, the island universes, as Hubble found out, were, you know, there was so many more of them. And yet the 1930s is just so recent. I mean, that really blows my mind.
I have to admit, for me, it was definitely Hubble's work proving that the vague nebulae that people were seeing through the telescopes wasn't actually nebulae, but it was actually external galaxies from our own. And of course, then there was Hall and Arp and redshifts and everything else. So Hubble, that's what it means to me a lot.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's about time we heard from the experts now. So let's hand over to Dr. Robert Smith, and we will learn a little bit more. So I'm here today at the University of Sussex with Dr. Robert Smith, who's an astronomer on site here. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also by Jane Green.
Hello, Richie, and hello, Dr. Smith.
Hello.
We are here to talk to you today about the cosmic distance ladder. So I wanted to start off with solar system measurements and how we actually determine how far away things are within our solar system.
Yes, it's all down to Kepler, really, because Kepler defined the three laws of planetary motion, and as a result of that, it was possible to construct a scale model of the solar system. You didn't have any individual distances, but you knew relative distances. So you knew, for example, the distance between the Sun and Jupiter in terms of the distance between the Sun and the Earth. Mm-hmm. And so what was lacking for a long time was an absolute scale. And people tried to do this by measuring the distance to passing asteroids, for example.
So if you've got an asteroid passing by, how on earth do you find out how far away that is?
Parallax, basically. So you measure the direction of the asteroid from two different points on the surface of the Earth, and if it gets close enough, then it will appear to be in two different directions, and you can use that and do a bit of geometry and get the distance of the asteroid. And you have to measure the orbit of the asteroid, of course, but you do that within this relative distance model of Kepler. Mm-hmm. And so you can now pinpoint a particular point in its orbit, and you get a scale for the whole solar system.
So when were the astronomers actually doing that in time-wise?
Well, the most recent accurate measurement was in the 1930s.
Why?
Previously, people had used things like transit of Venus, which is also, again, you measure how long it takes to go across the surface of the Sun, mm-hmm. and that gives you a scale, but it's not terribly accurate.
Right.
And measuring the distance of the asteroid wasn't terribly accurate either. We didn't really get an accurate measurement of the distance from the Earth to the Sun until the 1960s, when people realized that if you could catch Venus or Mercury at a point in the orbit where the angle between the Sun Mercury line and the Mercury Earth line was 90 degrees, and that's at maximum elongation when it's furthest from the Sun as seen from here.
Mm-hmm.
If you could measure the distance from the Earth to the planet at that time and measure the angle between the distance, the direction to the Sun and the direction to the planet, then you had enough information to solve the triangle. So the puzzle was how you measured the distance to the planet.
Mm.
And by the 1960s, it was getting possible to use radar. And so they would send a radar beam out to the planet, measure how long it took to get the echo back, and that gave a scale. And now we can measure that distance, the Earth-Sun distance, to 5 or 6 significant figures.
Wow.
So we really know that distance very accurately.
Of course, that brings us on to measuring distances to local stars as well.
Yes.
Most amateur astronomers have heard of parallax. If you could give us just a very brief overview of parallax and why it's important to know the solar system distances.
Well, parallax operates really in the same way as surveyors operate on the surface of the Earth. Suppose you want to measure the distance of a ship at sea. We obviously can't actually take a meter rod and take it out to sea. But if you measure the direction to the ship simultaneously from two different points separated by several hundred meters, say, you will get two different angles. So you know the baseline, which is the distance between the two observing points. You know the angles to the ship. And so you've got enough to solve the triangle and find out the distance of the ship.
Mm.
And you can use that method for stars as well, in principle, except that a few hundred meters is not nearly long enough as a baseline.
No.
What is done is, in fact, to use the Sun-Earth distance as the baseline.
Mm.
So it was really important to know that accurately.
Yes.
And that was partly why people were so keen to measure it. And if you measure the direction to a star at 2 times 6 months apart, then you've got a baseline which is actually twice the Earth-Sun distance.
Yeah.
And if you look at a star, it will appear to move in that time against the background of more distant stars,
mm-hmm.
which are far enough away that you can't really detect any difference in their direction.
Mm.
And it's a messy process.
That's with so much in astronomy.
Yes, it's not straightforward, but the principle is easy enough.
Yes.
That you measure the difference in direction of the star at least 2 times, and that gives you the angle between the two directions.
Right.
And it's very, very small.
Mm.
It's less than 1 second. And remember that there are 3,600 seconds in a degree.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a degree is already a pretty small angle.
Yes, stunning.
So it has to be done very, very precisely.
Mm.
And you don't just do it with 2 measurements, you do it with measurements over quite a long period of time. And complicated by the fact that the Sun itself is moving relative to the nearby stars.
Yes.
And it's moving by about twice the diameter of the Earth's orbit per year.
Who was the first astronomer to accurately measure the nearest star?
Well, by coincidence, the nearest star was actually measured in 1837. There were 3 people measured parallax for the first time in that year, and one of them measured Proxima Centauri, which is the nearest star. But he's not the one who gets the credit.
Oh, no.
Because he wasn't the first
not
in
another
that
one.
He wasn't the first in the year.
Right.
Bessel, I think, was the
Bessel,
first.
Friedrich Bessel, yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, so the nearest star has been measured that long ago. But it wasn't very accurate. The first measurements were not very accurate. But it proved that parallax existed, that these stars actually were at a finite distance.
Hmm. Which is, you know, very important, I guess, for determining the size of everything around us.
Absolutely, yes.
We've measured our parallax. We know sort of how far away these stars are, but, you know, there seems to be quite a lot of differences between different measurements. I mean,
as you said, you know, things have got more accurate over the years, but, you know, back in the 90s, for example, Hipparchos, the Hipparchos satellite measured quite a few distances, and even since then there's been significant changes in the distances as well. So it seems like the whole thing, even now, is quite fluid, isn't
it? A movable feast.
Yeah.
Well, it is. I mean, everything proceeds by successive approximations.
Right.
You know, the very earliest measurements are pretty rough, and you keep on refining and refining, and things get gradually better. But you can always do better, and you may make errors in your measurements, and you may underestimate the errors that you've made.
Mm-hmm.
There are random errors and there are systematic errors, and random errors are reasonably easy to deal with. Mm-hmm. Systematic errors are far harder, and that's when there's something which puts a bias into the measurement,
mm-hmm.
and then you, the whole thing is shifted by an amount which you maybe don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So Hipparchos was huge step forward because it measured the parallaxes and indeed the motions of millions of stars to quite a significant accuracy, much better than had been possible previously. But it's not a straightforward process. They're trying to measure so many stars that it all has to be done automatically. So you have to rely on your software package to do it correctly. The images are scanned by a machine. The images may not be perfect. One of the old problems with glass plates was that the lenses of the telescope weren't perfect, and so near the edges of the plate there were distortions. The same is actually true of the CCDs, because again, the telescope is not perfect. It's good, but it's not absolutely perfect.
Mm.
And so you have to correct for what used to be called plate constants.
Mm.
And that all has to be done using a big software package. And whereas statistically, the parallaxes are absolutely fine, any individual parallax might be wrong by a bit, by a small bit, perhaps, but probably by a bit that's hard to quantify.
Mm.
Mm.
So, although it's a big step forward, any individual parallax could still be called into question.
Dr. Smith and I were talking about the distance changes in Polaris over the past, you know, 20 years or so. The distances have changed significantly since the Hipparchos days.
Are those distances quite significant?
It's moved 30% closer.
30%?
Yeah.
That's a significant
change. Which is quite a lot.
Yeah.
In the past 20 years.
But I wouldn't say that's definitive.
Oh.
Because the methods that are being used are totally different.
Right. So what methods are they using to do that?
Polaris is an unusual star because it's a variable star. It's a Cepheid variable. And you probably know that there's a period luminosity relationship for Cepheids, which means that if you measure the period, you know the absolute brightness,
mm.
and then if you measure the apparent brightness, you can get the distance.
Yeah.
Fine. But these pulsating stars have different modes of pulsation,
right,
which have different periods.
Yes.
So you've also got to establish which mode of pulsation it's in.
Mm.
And normally you assume that it's in what's called the fundamental mode, but it might be in first overtone.
What does that mean?
Because it's a higher frequency.
Okay.
So it's a shorter period.
Right.
And so that's going to confuse the issue. You have to calibrate that differently.
Mm.
And in fact, there is a controversy as to whether Polaris is in this fundamental mode, which is the lowest frequency pulsation, or whether it's in a first overtone. So depending which it is, it may or may not give you this new answer.
So Hipparchos could be right, or it could be it's a different pulsation. And
that's right. That's right. If the Hipparchos one is right, it's probably in the first overtone. If it's in the fundamental mode, then Hipparchos is probably wrong. That's one of the complications. But that is the the period luminosity relation method of finding distance. But there is an additional way of doing it. One of the mainstays of the overall distance scale is the distance to the Hyades cluster. It's an open cluster. Galactic cluster is the other term. Few hundred stars. It's close enough that now with Hipparchos you can measure the distance of the cluster directly using parallax. And so we know what the main sequence looks like. We know for all the main sequence stars, which are the ones which have not yet evolved, they're still burning hydrogen in the center. For those stars, there's a definite relationship between the luminosity and the color. And we assume, for theoretical reasons, that all clusters have the same relationship between luminosity and color. Absolute luminosity, so absolute brightness and color. And so if you have an object which has got a particular color and you believe it's a main sequence object, then you know its absolute brightness. And the companion of Polaris, because it's also a binary, is a main sequence star, which is not pulsating or doing anything funny.
Right.
And so you can find the distance of that companion from main sequence fitting.
Right, yeah.
Looking at its absolute luminosity and being able to say, okay, we believe it to be this hot, therefore it should be this bright, therefore we can get a fit for the distance.
Yeah? Absolutely, right. Yes.
Okay.
And that is actually the method that was used to get this lower distance for Polaris.
Ah.
And if you believe that, then of course you can make arguments about which mode Cepheid is pulsating it. And the trouble is that some of the things are consistent with it being a fundamental mode pulsator, and some of the other data are consistent with it being a first overturn pulsator. So I think the jury is still out as to which is correct.
We're going to pause here for a minute and come back to the interview with Dr. Robert Smith and Jane Green and myself a little bit later on.
You are listening to Under British Skies, an astronomy.fm original programme with Richard Jarvis, Paul Harper, Nick Evitz, Nick Howes and Jane A. Green.
And welcome back. So
I hope you enjoyed the first part of that interview. As I said, it was great talking to Dr. Robert Smith. He was it was very, very interesting, and we'll have the second part of that in a short while. In the meantime, we just wanted to provide a little bit of context around this and talk about some of the terms that were used in that interview, talking about standard candles and Cepheid variable stars. And of course, at this point, I think it's worth mentioning that you know, we are talking about four candles, aren't we? Right, okay, and with that crass joke out of the way, I'm going to hand over to Jane, and she's going to tell us a little bit more.
Yes, because I think as it's become clear already on Earth, to measure any kind of distance, you just pace it out or you use radar beams or laser rays. In space, this is really only feasible for the moon and nearest planets. So to measure other varying distances, especially distances in the vastness of space, we use the cosmological distance ladder, because no single distance determination method can actually serve across all the scales of the universe. So we use what we call standard candles. Now, this is a type of celestial object that releases the same amount of energy regardless of where it is in space. So its distance is therefore the only thing that affects how bright it appears from Earth. Now, there are two main standard candles, and the first one is the Cepheid variable star. Now, Henrietta Swan Leavitt worked out that each Cepheid star's period of pulsation was tied to its average brightness. So the longer the pulsation period, the brighter the star. Now, this enabled their use as standard candles, and was confirmed actually by Arthur Eddington. Now, he proposed that the surface of the star trapped some of the outflowing radiation, so causing the surface to swell up before releasing that radiation and shrinking again. And he also showed that the density of the star determined the period of pulsation. So this meant that all Cepheids pulsating, for example, with a period of, say, 5.5 days, will be identical to one another. Thus, any two can be compared, and the difference in their observed average brightness can be used to calculate how much further one is than the other. So the comparison of Cepheid variable stars from one galaxy to another is one of the most heavily relied upon methods in distance determination. Now, of course, another standard candle, much, much, much brighter, is an exploding star, what we call a supernova, specifically a type 1A supernova. Now, this explosion is triggered when the burnt-out core of a dead star siphons gas from a nearby active star. The gas builds up on the surface of the dead star, increasing its mass. Now, when this crosses a well-defined threshold, something that's known as the Chandrasekhar limit, the star can no longer support its own weight and it collapses, triggering an enormous explosion. Now, because every supernova of this type is caused by the collapse of the central star when it reaches this limit, every one of these stellar cataclysms releases the same amount of energy into space. So, the brightness of a supernova type 1A is vastly greater than that of a Cepheid variable star. In fact, it can outshine a Cepheid variable something like, or by 100 billion stars put together. So, it's very, very bright. But of course, across the universe, that's very, very useful. But the drawback to this standard candle is that the destination of these stars is very, very hard to predict. In fact, it's almost impossible to predict because statistically there's only about one supernova in the galaxy every century. So it's not ideal. But once the supernova is sighted, the distance of its host galaxy can be calculated relative to another galaxy, and then they're able to work out the distance. So it's like joining two rungs on the ladder.
Thank you very much for that, Jane. So that's a brilliant explanation of Cepheid variables and type 1A supernova. It's worth pointing out as well that the term Cepheid originates from the star Delta Cephei in the constellation of Cepheus, the first type of this star identified by John Goodrich in 1784. As Jane said earlier on, they're of particular importance because they allow, because of the particular way in which they pulsate, that allows the absolute brightness to be determined, and therefore using the inverse square law, the amount of light that actually reaches the Earth, astronomers can then figure out, not exactly how far away it is, but a rough estimate of, how far away that object is. Now, it's worth pointing out as well that as you get a bit further out on the cosmic distance ladder, there are other ways of determining how far away something is. So in the second part of the interview, Dr. Robert Smith talks about redshift. Now, redshift is something quite interesting. It's a term which astronomers use quite heavily when they're talking about distant galaxies, pretty much because it's the only way to actually determine how far away something is once you can't look at individual stars within that galaxy. Now, what redshift is all about is that the universe is expanding. So Hubble proved, or Hubble postulated this back in the 30s. When he looked at the spectra of particular stars, so this is looking at the different wavelengths of different chemicals within the spectra, taking a spectroscopic measurement of the stars, that the absorption lines in the spectrum were shifted. And that actually led him to postulate that things were actually moving away from us. Because as Christian Doppler discovered in 1842, that the distance between the source of light and the observers was shrinking. The light would be squashed and become bluer. And if they were going, if the things were traveling away from us, then the wavelengths would change and they would be redshifted. Hence we get the term redshift.
Yeah, then that takes us rather nicely onto Albert Einstein and his general theory of relativity, because general relativity provided the mathematical framework within which to properly understand the meaning of Hubble's work. Now, it too proposed that the galaxies were separating from one another, But rather than individual galaxies speeding through space, its premise was that space itself was expanding and carrying the galaxies along with it, rather like the raisins in the cake mixture, which when you put it in the oven, if you imagine that the raisins are the galaxies, and then the dough expands and takes the galaxies, takes the raisins with it, the same is happening in space. It's not actually that the galaxies are rushing away from each other, although on the nearer they are to each other, yes, that does happen, but on the broad scale, it's actually the very fabric of space itself that is expanding and taking the galaxies with it. And the more
I find that such a mind-blowing concept.
Yeah, I know it is. It is. And the more space between a pair of galaxies, the faster they are driven apart, and of course the greater the redshift, the more the light is shifted, the wavelengths are expanded. So when astronomers talk about a redshift of 1, they mean that the light has been doubled in wavelength. And to do this, that means the universe must have doubled in size while the light has been travelling, which is another mind-blowing concept, isn't it? And a redshift of 2 means that the light's wavelength has quadrupled, hence the universe has doubled in size twice, meaning it's now 4 times as big as when the light from the galaxy started its journey, which is pretty mind-numbing, isn't it? But of course, all that relies on the Hubble constant, which is something else. Again, maybe we don't have time for that in this program.
Yeah, the Hubble constant is an interesting one. And again, Dr. Robert Smith gave us a pretty good explanation of that in part 2, which we're going to go to now.
And now, let's continue with the interview we were listening to earlier, talking to Dr. Robert Smith with myself and Jane Green.
That then leads us on to the use of Cepheid variables as one of the methods to measuring distances to nearby galaxies, of course.
Yes.
And if we can't measure the distance to a nearby Cepheid variable, you know, accurately enough, how far does that skew the distances to a distant galaxy? Let's rewind a little bit first, though. So, measuring distances to a nearby galaxy using these standard candles, the Cepheids, the RR, LIRI, the different relationships, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that first.
Yes, well, I mentioned the Cepheid luminosity relation, so let's start with that. It was first discovered actually in an external galaxy in the Small Magellanic Cloud about 100 years ago by female astronomer Henrietta Leavitt at Harvard.
Really good to hear you say that.
Yeah, well, there were a considerable number of able female astronomers at Harvard at
yes.
that time.
Yeah.
She was one of them, and she was observing variable stars in the Small Magellanic Cloud, and she noted that there appeared to be a relationship between their apparent brightness and the period of pulsation. Mm-hmm. And that was the first measurement of period luminosity relation. But of course, they couldn't convert that apparent brightness into an absolute brightness because they didn't know the distance of the Small Magellanic
yes.
Cloud.
It's like a catch-22, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
So the only way around that was to calibrate it using Cepheids in our own galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is that Polaris is a bit exceptional, it's so close.
Mm.
Most Cepheids are too far away for parallax.
Right.
What you have to do is you have to find Cepheids in clusters and then use this main sequence fitting method
yes.
to find the distance of the cluster, and that gives you the absolute brightness of the Cepheid.
Right.
And that way you can calibrate the period luminosity relationship.
Mm.
And it comes back a little bit to what I was saying earlier about things being statistically correct but individual things may be wrong.
Yes.
That if you have enough Cepheids, then statistically that relationship will be reliable,
mm-hmm.
even though any individual Cepheid may not fit it perfectly.
Mm.
And hence the errors you get with all these measurements, which
yeah.
amateurs so glibly ignore when we're talking amongst each other.
Yeah. So you have to know what the uncertainties are. I mean, a measurement is actually useless if you don't know the uncertainty.
Mm.
Right, yeah.
And that's something we drum into our students from their first year onwards, and it usually takes them to the final year before they've really grasped that.
Yes. Excellent. So, you know, we talked about safety variables. There are other ways to measure distances to nearby galaxies as well, though.
Yes, well, you mentioned RLRI stars. That's another kind of variable star. And again, as far as the optical light is concerned, it appears that all our Olari stars have the same intrinsic brightness. And so if you can measure their apparent brightness, you have the distance straight off. You don't need to measure anything else. That, of course, requires calibration too. And that gets a bit more complicated because although there are lots and lots of these objects around, again, none of them, or not very many of them, are close enough for parallax. So you have to use statistical arguments, which are a bit too complicated to talk about on a radio show. I might just about do it if I was able to show you a diagram, but since, sorry audience, you can't see it.
They might be breathing a big sigh of relief.
Let's just say there are statistical arguments you can use to find what that absolute brightness is. And so that gives you an independent method for measuring distances to nearby galaxies. But they're not as bright as Cepheids, so Cepheids you can use to more distant objects. And then once you've... the Cepheids go out to, well, probably the distance of the Virgo cluster, which is already fairly far away. Probably 30 million light years, something of that sort. I can't remember the current number. And by the time you get out that far, you're beginning to see a reasonable number of supernovae popping off. And supernovae are quite remarkable objects, particularly what are called type 1A supernovae, because it appears that those that we can measure the distance for all have the same absolute brightness. And actually there's quite a good theoretical reason for that, because they're thought to occur in binary systems when a white dwarf in that system is accreting material, and when it reaches a certain critical mass, it collapses. And then the material which is collapsing in bounces, and you get a shock wave, and the whole thing explodes. So because it's a critical mass, you expect the brightness of that explosion to be the same for all the objects,
regardless of the size of the individual stars which are causing it.
Well, the point is that it's a critical mass of the white dwarf, so the mass is the same for all the objects. The mass that underlies the explosion is the same in all cases.
I suppose what makes that tricky, though, is the fact that you, I think on average, you have perhaps one supernova in a galaxy per century, and sometimes it's quite serendipitous, isn't it, to actually spot one going off.
So you actually need quite a lot of intermediate distance indicators as well in order to calibrate the supernovae.
And what would those intermediate distance indicators be?
Well, one thing you can use, you have to look for something which is a bit brighter than a Cepheid. And the brightest objects in our galaxy are red supergiants. And so they can be used by looking at red supergiants in external galaxies that give you another handle on the distance of these objects. Because the red supergiants tend to occur in clusters, particularly globular clusters now. You can find the distances to globular clusters using our Olari stars, because there are lots of our Olari stars in globular clusters, and then you can look at the brightness of the brightest stars in these globular clusters and use that as an indicator.
So it really is the cosmological distance ladder, isn't it? It's creating the rungs on the ladder, isn't
That's
it?
That's right.
To the most first.
And it all goes back to the distance between the Earth and the Sun.
Yes, because that's the sort of known, that is the known upon which you
the
can build,
astronomical unit, so-called.
Yes.
So that's the fundamental rung on the ladder.
Yes.
And everything else depends on that.
Yes. We've come a long way.
Yes.
That hasn't been an understatement, hasn't it? But we have.
A very long way. A very long way indeed. And of course, the last rung on the ladder, of course, is when we start talking about redshift.
Yes, because in the early, well, about 100 years ago, people were measuring the recession velocities of galaxies. Mm-hmm. And a guy called Slipher was very involved in that, Cummerson as well. And all these measurements were put together ultimately by Hubble. And at the end of the 20s, he produced a paper which suggested that the velocities of recession were proportional to the distance of the galaxy. Now, he didn't have the data really to justify that statement, but it turned out to be correct.
Right. So he was lucky too.
He was lucky too, yes. So as people got more and more distances to further and further galaxies, this was borne out, and we now have what's called Hubble's law, where the velocity is directly proportional to the distance. Mm. And the constant of proportionality is Hubble's constant.
Yes.
And so it became very important to measure the value of that constant, so that all you needed to do was measure the velocity of recession, and you had a distance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And for the most distant galaxies, that is the only way of doing it, in fact. And of course, you can actually use that, once it's established, to help to calibrate the supernovae.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's a kind of...
feeds in, doesn't it? Yeah. One informs the other.
Absolutely. Mm. So it's really quite a complicated chain of argument. I haven't time to mention all the other little methods that there are, but there are two ways you can look at this problem. Mm. One is to say, well, I will just make a little ladder or a chain of argument where each step depends on the previous one, and you just work your way out choosing the best indicator at each stage. And that's one way of doing it. And in the 1960s and 70s, Alan Sandage followed this procedure, and he found a Hubble constant which he claimed was 55 plus or minus 5 in units of kilometers per second per megaparsec, parsec being about 3 and a bit light years. Mm-hmm. At the same time, other groups were using a different technique where at each stage they used a variety of methods and took the best average. And so at each stage there were many methods being used, and you had more of a network than a chain of argument. And working on that basis, Gerard de Vaucouleurs in the States and Sidney Vandenberg in Canada came up with a value which was more like 95 plus or minus 10.
Which is a significant units. Difference.
Yeah, not within the errors. Mm. They were both claiming 10% accuracy, but they were differed by a factor of 2.
Yes.
So there was something wrong somewhere.
Yes.
It took a long time to resolve that. Some of it was to do with not properly taking account of reddening in nearby galaxies, because light coming from distant objects gets scattered and some of it's lost by dust between us and them. And other things were, one of the measurements assumed that you were looking at H2 regions, which are regions are nebulae, ionized gas, which is glowing very hot, and in fact turned out that that's not what they were looking at. And there were various other things of that kind. And eventually things have settled down, and now there is the received value for the Hubble constant is hovering around 70 in these units.
Right.
People claim they can measure it to 1 or 2%. I don't believe that. I think there's still uncertainties of probably more like 5%. Mm. But it really is 5 or 10% now, rather than
much smaller.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But even once you've got that Hubble constant, and you've been able to get redshift, actually working out a layman's distance seems to be quite difficult as well.
Yes. Well, of course, it's not helped by the fact that we're at these distances, we're looking back in time.
Mm. Mm.
And you really need a model of the universe in order to interpret the data.
Yes.
And so at these very big distances, the values become model dependent.
Yes.
And the very latest value for the Hubble constant is claimed to be accurate to 1 or 2%, and it comes from looking at the microwave background radiation and fitting the observations to a model of the universe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The so-called cold dark matter model of actually lambda CDM, as it's now called, because lambda is the cosmological constant.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think we've time to go into.
No.
But there is a canonical model of the universe, and if you believe that canonical model, then you can measure Hubble's constant to about 1%.
Right.
But, of course, the model could be wrong.
Mm.
Yeah.
Again, it's shifting sands, isn't it?
It is shifting sands. I mean, what you read in the papers, of course, is an exact result.
Yes.
It's never like that.
No.
It's all very complicated, and the people who actually work in the field, of course, recognise this, but when they're publicising their results, they don't emphasise the uncertainties.
Right, yeah. Talking of uncertainty as well, if we go back to, as we were discussing earlier, Edwin Hubble and in the 1920s, we didn't really know that there was a galaxy, an island universe beyond the galaxy that we were in, and how far we've come since the 1920s and 30s
to know that there
is more than one galaxy. In fact, there are a few hundred billion other galaxies out there in a very short space of time.
Yes. Well, the interesting thing about that is that in 1885, there was a supernova went off in Andromeda, but nobody knew about supernovae in those days.
Yeah, really? So there's the evidence.
It was just
called a
nova.
Yes.
Like Kepler's and Tycho's supernovae around 1600.
Yes.
I mean, they were, you know, they were new stars. They were novae. The term supernova wasn't coined until the 1930s. So they were compared, the one in 1885 in Andromeda was compared with ordinary novae in our own galaxy.
Yes.
And
yes.
So it was thought that the Andromeda galaxy, as we now say, was a small object in our own galaxy.
Yes. Yeah. Shocking, really, isn't it? But understandable.
It wasn't until Hubble found Cepheids in the Andromeda galaxy that they go, hang on a minute.
Yes.
There's something funny going on. Mm. And they realised that this had been an exceptional object. And it was from that point on that people began to recognise that there were novae and there were supernovae.
Yes.
Mm. And this had been a supernova.
Mm.
And once that was recognised, suddenly, Andromeda was much bigger and much further away.
Yes. Yeah, Healy calculated it to I think it was 900,000 light years. And of course, now it's 2.5 million.
Yeah, but at least it was the right ballpark.
Yes.
Yeah. And that, of course, was to do with it. There's another horrible complication in the Cepheid period, the luminosity relation, because there are two types of Cepheid, which differ in brightness by a factor of 4. And this difference was not really recognised until around 1950. And people were calibrating the period luminosity relationship using the wrong kind of Cepheid. And so they got wrong by a factor of 4 in brightness, which corresponds to a factor of 2 in distance.
Mm.
And when this was recognised in the early 50s, the size of the universe doubled overnight.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's been excellent to talk to you today, and it's been fascinating talking to you about the cosmic distance ladders.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yes. It's been a pleasure for me too, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Just like to say a huge thank you to Dr. Robert Smith from the University of Sussex for giving us such a wonderful explanation of a cosmic distance ladder. Jane and I really enjoyed ourselves going and talking to him, and hopefully you can hear that in the interview. Right, now I'm very pleased to report that Paul Harper has managed to join us. He had a few technical problems earlier on, but Paul, you managed to sort your PC out.
I'm back, I'm back.
All right, well, thank you for joining us. So, right, what I wanted to talk about now is let's just have a little look about, you know, we've understood how astronomers are measuring these distances, but I don't know about you, but it's just changing all the time, isn't it?
It is. In fact, you know, Dr. Robert Smith said that it's
a movable feast, shifting sands, because very often when something is said to be right, it is a fact. We find that, in fact, sometimes within just a year or so, in some cases even less, you find that that fact is changing. I mean, that certainly applies at the moment, doesn't it, to the discovery of exoplanets. When we're finding so many of them, we set up a standard, fit it to a model, and then we're having to change those models as well because we're discovering more and more things all the time.
Don't you think that though science is evolving, and as it evolves, we're getting better knowledge? And of course, we're observing closer to the Big Bang. We're radio telescopes are now can listen in to the Big Bang, and you can get very close to this. So I think, you know, perhaps in 50, 20 years' time, we'll have a greater understanding, may have an exact distance, perhaps. Who knows?
I know this. Why not? Absolutely. And it's quite a frightening thought to think. I mean, as we said earlier, in the 1930s, we didn't know that there were more galaxies. Now, you know, the models estimate that there could be at least 500 billion galaxies. Now, what are we going to know in another 10 years? It's quite frightening, actually, because we're going to advance as quickly as the technology will allow us to advance. And it's going to be rapid, absolutely rapid.
Well, you know, is it the case that we're going to find out that the models we've got already are wrong and everything's going to shrink again?
Why not? Maybe. Maybe.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the thing is, with our technology changing at the speed it is, the equipment we're using currently is going to be obsolete and out of date. When we put a new satellite up, again, and we just do a check on the data we received, for instance, the Hipparchus issues, we find it's completely changed. So... Mm. Thing is, technology changes and evolves, and sometimes we have to adjust our way of thinking. An analogy, if you like, is look how long it took to build the Large Hadron Collider to look for the Higgs. We found the Higgs. Now we're looking to see if we can prove supersymmetry, etc., with it. So it's a constantly evolving process, and yet it will contradict what we previously considered to be a fact.
Do you think, though, that the James Webb telescope that's going up in a few years' time, I think I'm going to get it right, will make a big difference?
Yes, because it's instead of looking in optical like the Hubble does right now, now we're looking in the near infrared with the James Webb. So it's going to be looking at the same sky, but in a different way. It's going to see things that we don't see at optical. And I think one of the things that has really worked out well is combining data from all the various other systems we're using. We've got Newton, we've got Chandra, we've got the Hubble, and bring them all in to make one image. That has changed fundamentally what we thought was the correct picture. Now, and Gaia is going to do this again. It's going to change everything. It's a new milestone for us up there. The technology is more up to date, and it will tell us stuff we didn't know or that we couldn't properly detect and confirm.
It's worth pointing out, so you just mentioned Gaia then, or Gaia. I always pronounce it Gaia, I don't know about you, but Gaia, I suppose, sounds better. But so this is another ESA mission. The Hipparchus satellite was an ESA mission. So the Gaia satellite is actually out there at the moment and is taking measurements of so many more stars.
Something like 100 billion stars.
That's just insane. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Insane. It's insane. But, you know, the aim is to improve these measurements to distant stars. You know, and that's going to give us a lot better understanding of our local universe. So, you know, or our local galaxy, or a part of our local galaxy even, because it's not even going to measure right out to distant galaxies. It's just looking at, you know, nearby space.
The cosmic doorstep.
Yeah, the cosmic doorstep, indeed.
Isn't it frustrating, though, when we sit here discussing it so lightly, but isn't it frustrating that, you know, say 20, 30 years down the line, people will be sitting in their radio studios discussing something else incredible, and we won't be there? You know, we won't be up because, you know, I mean, say 50, 100 years from now, what will they be discussing then?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Perhaps I could just bring in, as devil's advocate, there are still people out there, you know, very religious people, and you have to respect their views, who still think, you know, the universe is only 4,000 years old. the religious people in the Bible Belt still believe that the Earth is, well, sorry, the Earth is the center of the universe, that the Earth is over just over 4,000 years old, and there's still people around and still taught in schools this particular religion.
I think, Nick, it's actually 6,000 years old, I think.
Well, 5,000.
Give or take a couple of thousand years.
I have a real problem with this, and I don't think you have to respect their views. I really don't think you have to respect their views, because their views are just nonsense.
I know, but when you think about it, look at the broader picture. If you think, in fact, we've had an example this evening where people, they pilloried Colin Pillinger, didn't they, with Beagle 2? And there are countless examples. I mean, the path of astronomy is littered with people who have been pilloried for what they've said or done or discovered and said is a fact.
Astrophysics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in every subject that you can think of, it's how we advance. So we have to be careful when we're, you know, dismissing one thing over another, for sure.
Jane, I'm reminded of the time that Professor Stephen Hawking was in Rome at a cosmological conference, and the church blessed the whole thing, as they just reminded him, don't meddle in things which are God's affairs, saying, because they were talking about looking back to the beginning of the universe. And I say, no, you shouldn't be doing that. That's down to God. Leave his mysteries alone. And of course, obviously, Stephen and company thought, yeah, right, we're not going to bother with that, listening to them. Let's go forward. And they went forward. They're still pushing the boundaries. Leonard Susskind, Stephen.
I know, because you have to, oh dear, this is definitely devil's advocate, and I swore I'd keep out of this. But if God created us, and God created us and gave us inquiring minds, so we have inquiring minds to ask these questions and to go out there. And he, being an all-knowing essence, deity, whatever, however, your deity, he must have known that we would do this.
Well, if you put it like that, not only must he know that we would do it, he must have predetermined that we would do it.
That's right.
You know.
That's right.
But the problem I have with it is, from my point of view, it's like, okay, so you can make theories, you know, all of what we've talked about tonight are at the end of the day theories, right? You can't definitively prove them absolutely, because you can't get a ruler and measure a distance to the nearest star, right? It's still a theory. It's a good fit. It's a good fit, but, you know, as we discovered when talking to Dr. Robert Smith, it's a good fit, but there's a bit of a fudge factor in there. And the problem I have with the whole idea of the Bible being correct is that it isn't a good fit in any way, shape or form with any of the facts that are
This is a whole new area.
It is a whole new area. But,
and we have to keep to astronomy.
Yes, we do have to
indeed
keep astronomy.
I should mention that I do go to church, but because I just go to church, I still believe in the Big Bang Theory and all the other things.
Yes.
So there are a lot of scientists who do go to church. So it's a widely accepted thing. People who think the Earth is, or sorry, the universe is a few thousand years old are wrong. That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
I think it's more of a metaphor, really. I mean, that's the way I look at it.
I think I'm right in saying, actually, that a number of the Apollo astronauts became religious after going into space as well.
Religion is a difficult thing. And I think
what is wonderful is that we have minds that do inquire. We want to know. We want to go out there. We want to know how big the universe is. We want to know how it began. And we will always pursue that knowledge. We will always want to know. And, of course, the thing I find quite mind-blowing is, you know, that the size of the observable universe, i.e. the universe that our technology has enabled us to see, the light that we can receive, which is a finite speed limit, so we can only see the light that has reached us. What about all the light beyond the boundary of the observable universe that we haven't seen? How could we possibly think that we could know? And a really classic example was the recent discovery of the supercluster, the Laniakea supercluster,
how big is it? About 500,000 light years wide, I think. Previously, not really, not discovered, not measured. And they've measured it now and found that the Milky Way galaxy is very, very small and lost inside a massive supercluster. So things are changing all the time. It is a movable feast.
It is, definitely. And I think that's where we should leave the cosmic distance ladder discussion at the moment. I mean,
lost
in the mist.
Lost in space.
Astronomers and human beings have a better understanding today than they have ever had of the size of the universe, but it is by no means a definitive fact. Right, Paul, you were going to tell us about what you were going to be up to next month as well.
Indeed, coming up in just a few weeks' time on Friday the 6th of February and Saturday the 7th of February is the European Astrofest at Kensington Town Hall. It's an annual event of convention. Unfortunately, all the tickets for Saturday are sold for the convention, but there's still the exhibition, which costs about £8 to get into. And I should be moving around on the Friday and doing various interviews and catching a few people and perhaps catching ordinary members of the public. Who knows?
Yeah, so if you see Paul there, make sure you say hello and give him a handshake or buy him a beer as well, or a cup of tea at least.
Or give me a Spocky sign.
Yeah, give him a Spocky sign. Right, and then just one final thing before we all say goodbye tonight. On the 1st of February, it will be the NASA Day of Remembrance. Each year, NASA remembers the fallen. This year, they are observing on the 10th anniversary of the Columbia incident. And it's time for us all to say goodbye. So, goodbye, everybody. Jane?
Goodbye, Richie, and thank you for listening.
Good night.
And it's good night for him.
You have been listening to Under British Skies, an astronomy.fm original programme with Richie Jarvis, Paul Harper, Nick Evitts, Nick Howes and Jane A. Green. The show is engineered by Michael Forster and Rob Keehan and produced by the team. Previous episodes of Under British Skies are available to download for free from the astronomy.fm website or on the iTunes astronomy.fm channel. Under British Skies is licensed under the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Sharealike license. You can contact the team via the astronomy.fm chat room or by emailing ubs@astronomy.fm or via our Under British Skies Facebook page or via our Twitter account @UnderBritishSky. Under British Skies is broadcast live on astronomy.fm on the third Sunday of every month at 8 p.m. GMT.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts. AFM.